faithfulness and refrain from action, allowing injury to innocent people. In practice, all these sutras raise subtle moral and relational issues and are to be understood with great care. Mere common sense or scholarly knowledge will not help. That is how I want to say for the present about Yama Niyama. Internal and external purification, contentment, fiery aspiration, spiritual breathing and devotion to Ishvara constitute Niyama. Not one of these is possible. Not one of these is possible. I read again. Internal and external purification, contentment, fiery aspiration, spiritual reading, devotion to Ishvara constitute Niyama. Niyama, the five rules of life, includes internal and external purification, contentment and fiery aspiration. One is on fire. The heat of efforts exceeding the heat at the core of the sun. These are followed by spiritual, compared to which inspiration, intuition and perception appear insignificant and ineffectual, and finally devotion to Ishvara of the Gurudeva. At this stage, one has yet not known or seen Ishvara the Gurudeva. The sutra hints at advanced practices, and when these practices culminate in experience of the inner Ishvara, adoration springs from the heart and mind for the real Gurudeva. In this journey, one first establishes communication with psychic man within, then the inner and external man jointly have communication with Chitti and reach the stage of perception. Finally, bodies, brains, mind, chitti are all set aside and direct communication is set up with Ishvara, the Gurudeva. This is the beginning of spiritual reading. Niyama is therefore the crowning prize and effect of yoga abhyasa. What is the difference between Niyama here and the early Yama? Yama is moral prohibitive, while Niyama is disciplinary and requires yoga sadhana and practices. A clean moral life, a sound moral foundation is a very necessary prerequisite in yoga. And the first step is laid down in Yama, whilst Niyama lays down the practices for discipline leading to purification of the various sheaths of vehicles, penance, study, purification, etc. That is why I wish to put Yama, Niyama later. Because it will remain only words in your mind as I am talking to you. The word spiritual reading has no meaning. The word Ishvara has no meaning. Therefore, to talk at this stage about these things is impossible. We'll go now further, come to it again later, when we understand more of these sutras. When thoughts which are contrary to yoga are present, there should be the cultivation of their opposite. Ishvara is not an entity to be pleased by flattery. It is human to be assailed by thoughts which are contrary to yoga. At that time, when our body-brain system is suddenly assaulted and such thoughts demand a pound of flesh, how are we to react? This happens so suddenly that one has no time to have contrary thoughts in that instant. And what is the use of bringing in contrary thoughts after the harmful thoughts have already assailed us? There are two ways by which we can guard ourselves against such sudden attacks. By checking our drifts often, we find certain dominant tendencies in our thoughts, and we practice the appropriate corrective exercise as preventive measures. 2. According to nature's law, rhythmic breathing takes care of thinking and keeps it rhythmic and steady. Let us therefore impose 3-step rhythmic breathing on ourselves for all 24 hours to be safe and protected from such sudden assaults. Some time back, I think a month or two back, I told you to play the game the small children play, stop. Play that game with your own sense. During the whole day, 20-30 times, suddenly stop and think what you were thinking. Catch yourself what you were thinking about. You'll always be either in the past or in the future. That does not matter. But what is the persistent thought that is coming to you? Though we may be very much engrossed in our work, a part of our brain we make use of part of our brain for our work. The maximum part of the brain therefore roams into the past, roams into the future. So if you suddenly stop and say, where am I? You will find that certain emotions are very strong with you. Then over a period, you find that these emotions are predominant. You go to corrective exercise and try those corrective exercises. That will be one way of putting your brain to order. But the most important is the 3-step rhythmic breathing, because your brain processes and your breathing process are interdependent. If your breathing is rhythmic, your thinking has to be rhythmic. If your thinking is rhythmic, you cannot be assaulted by unwanted thoughts. I've seen people do this, as if shaking their head can shake unwanted thoughts away. By shaking your head, you cannot shake your thoughts away. Some people do this, they are sorry for such thoughts. It doesn't help. You have to take corrective measures. Therefore, during the day, your conscious day, catch yourself 20, 30, 40 times a day as to where you are. What is the predominant thought? What is the predominant emotion? And then try to correct these thoughts, correct these emotions. And very soon, you will be at peace much more. And also, of course, your rhythmic breathing. That must come to you more and more and more. You get my point? Otherwise, suddenly, like a tidal wave, we are carried away. Thoughts that are contrary to yoga are harmfulness, falsehood, theft, incontinence, avarice, whether committed personally, cause to be committed or approved of, whether arising from avarice, anger or ignorance, whether slight in doing, middling or great. These result always in excessive pain and ignorance. For this reason, the contrary thoughts must be cultivated. The sage expresses beautifully how to handle thoughts contrary to yoga, implying thereby that yoga is the right rhythmic way of life, and any thought that jars this rhythm must be a wrong thought. Thoughts of harmfulness, falsehood, theft, incontinence and avarice are contrary to yoga, and they are further denounced as whether committed personally, caused to be committed or approved of, whether arising from avarice, anger or ignorance, whether slight in doing, middling or great. Improper thoughts and emotions may lead to improper actions, the instrument of which may be one's own self or another. Taimini quotes the Buddha. Inaction in a deed of mercy is action in a deadly sin. The result invariably is excessive pain. For this reason, inculcating contrary thoughts as per method, that is, the corrective practices as given, is always essential and should be cultivated. They are preventive and in the long run protective. In presence of him who has perfected harmlessness, all enmity ceases. To maintain harmlessness is not easy, especially under provocation. When one is strong, then ahimsa has virtue. If one is weak, it is only a cover. Mere preaching of ahimsa, non-violence, can only lead to great hinsa or violence. In the country of Sri Rama and in our modern days, Mahatma Gandhiji, we see unprecedented violence throughout the country. The other day, I read in the newspaper, it required 2 bullets to kill Mahatma Gandhi, 35 bullets to kill Indira Gandhi, and bomb to kill Sanjay Gandhi. How violence is increasing day by day. You get this point? We are not getting free from violence, we are getting deeply involved in the violence. Why? Because we have been preaching non-violence. When a little child is told not to do a thing, it will do it all the more. When you preach something, people will do the opposite. When you preach non-violence, there will be violence. When you preach ekta, there will be no ekta. Therefore, the moral of the story is, don't preach. That's the safest thing to do. Don't preach. Can do what? Instead of preaching, give by example. Instead of preaching, give by example. Live a life such that others, by seeing that, will like to lead such a life. Preaching will not do. The more you preach, the worse the situation will become. See? So this is all here stated. Unless ahimsa and non-violence has seeped into every pore of the body and in every cell of the complex structure of the human body-brain system, enmity will not cease. This is vividly portrayed in Light on the Path by Mary Collins. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. Before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to wound. These lines hint at something beyond hinsa or physical aggression. You understand these simple lines? Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. That means you become hard-hearted? No. Gautama left his wife and children and palace and kingdom when he saw an old man, a dead man, a diseased man, and said, this is no place to live. After 8 years, after his enlightenment, when he came back, a young woman came to him with a dead child and said, Master, give it life. And he very quietly said, Mother, that which is born must die. Bury the child. You understand? The same Buddha had become free from tears. When understanding comes, emotion ceases, wrong emotion ceases. You understand the law and you are guided by the law. You don't emotionally cry or get angry. And further she says, before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Try telling one of your ministers you are a damn fool and see what results. That minister will be red in the face and put you behind bars. You see? So, before the ears can hear, they must lose their sensitiveness. Very soon one is offended, very soon, you see. When your ego leaves you, nothing will hurt you that you hear. And finally, the most important sentence. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must have lost the power to whom. So long as you control not to use a language to hurt somebody else, you have achieved nothing. But when you want to hurt somebody and you cannot have a language to hurt, when it has become impossible for you to hurt, and you have lost the power to wound, that is the stage of achievement. We normally do not want to hurt others, as long as we are not hurt. If we are hurt, we don't hesitate to hurt in return. But when there is no resistance, there is no control not to hurt, but you simply cannot hurt, you have no language to use to hurt somebody, then you have achieved something. So when you start on the path to yoga, these are the first three lines you must remember. Before the eyes can see, before the ears can be heard, and before the tongue can have lost the power to move. You see, this is the beginning of the path, not the end of the path. When you begin, when you come here to begin something, to know something, to learn something, these are the first three steps regarding your mind, regarding your speech, regarding your ear. Understand? When truth to all beings is perfected, the effectiveness of his words and act is immediately to be seen. Truth has great strength. Let us here recount the story of Yudhishthira, half lie to Dronacharya, which cost the latter his life. The teacher questioned, "Dear Yudhishthira, your wealth is truth. Is Ashwatthama there?" To this, Yudhishthira's reply was, "It is true that Ashwatthama is there. In his mind, he may have had the vision of the elephant named Ashwatthama, whom he had seen as dead. What he did convey was entirely different. Was it his desire in this battle, which was fought to finally let truth triumph, that made him act so?" Yudhishthira, you know, was the Mahatma, the man who never told a lie. When you don't have to tell a lie, are you permitted to tell a lie under certain circumstances? To save your skin, to save your country, to save your wife or children? Or you say the truth in all cases? These are difficult, very difficult. If to save your wife and children, if you don't tell the truth, to let them see dead, these are very difficult things. These are inclusive in Yama and Niyama. So Yudhishthira, under what circumstances he told an half lie, this can be judged from the man who never told an untruth, whose chariot was always 6 inches above the ground. From that day it touched the ground. That was the wages of untruth. So if Yudhishthira can tell an untruth, what are we? So when we'll come to Yama and Niyama, we'll know the force of Yama and Niyama. what strength is required morally, internally, to stand to this yama and niyama. It's not so easy. When abstention from theft is perfected, the yogi can have whatever he desires. Theft is relative on all planes of existence. Some can be honest for small gain, some can be honest for larger gains, some are honestly able to discard the three worlds, bhu-bhuva swaha, and some are honest in their thoughts and even in their dreams. You know the dream? In Satya Yuga, Harishchandra, in his dream, gave away his kingdom to Vishwamitra. In the morning, Vishwamitra comes to him and says, "Where is my kingdom?" So in dream, whatever you promise, you have to give. Such is required from yama and niyama. So before you go further, make yourself certain that you want to go further. Here all manner of theft is included. If abstention from all levels of theft is perfected, all sorts of riches fall into one's lap. So the sutra says. By abstention from incontinence, creative energy is acquired. We have already mentioned about sex and the misunderstood term brahmacharya in the exposition. But to indulge in sex and thus, not to indulge in sex and thus preserve this vital force does help in building up great creative energy. Nevertheless, marriage and the life of a householder is very essential for the practice of yoga. Physical muscles are developed against resistance offered by springs and waves. Similarly, sansara provides all the resistance required to develop spiritual muscles. But even a slight indulgence is out of question. Only as duty to God and nature to allow good souls to be born and guided from birth. When abstention from avarice is perfected, there comes an understanding of the law of rebirth. Like theft, avarice is relative. It can be very subtle. It can enter our house by the back door. Before we are aware and before we find ourselves, we have trespassed mentally. We have observed in the foregoing sutra how the disciple perfects himself or herself. First come the corrective exercises for thoughts which are contrary to yoga. Then come the firm achievement of the harmlessness, followed by abstention from theft, from incontinence, and finally avarice. This total and cumulative effect then brings the disciple the power to know and understand the aspects of life, that is birth and death. However, at this stage, the disciple must continue the many practices and techniques shown in the book. Internal and external purification produces aversion for desire, aversion for or desire to be free from form, both one's own and all forms in the three worlds. Internal purification automatically leads to external purification, though the contrary is not possible. When internal purification by various practices and means already suggested is brought about, one no longer wishes to take a form, that is, have existence in any of the three worlds. Form is necessary as long as internal purification has not been established. This applies even to existence in the sixth and seven sub-stages of Swaha, which are Indra's high heaven. Though purification comes, through purification comes also a quiet spirit, concentration, conquest of the organs, and ability to see the self. All this is not possible. In 240, introduces internal purification. 241 spells out results therefrom, benefits which come unasked for. Sattva Suddhi is the mental purity or mental integrity. the balancing of the gunas, especially tamas and rajas by sattva, and the control of the senses brings about worthiness to be able to see and know Ishvara. But for such an outcome to materialize, one must establish not only internal purification but also various communication links between the external man and the internal man, with Chitti and then with Ishvara, the Gurudeva, within. Only then is all that is stated here possible. You see, more and more you read, more and more Yama, Niyama seems impossible. As a result of contentment, bliss is achieved. Only now, at this later stage, that the sage talk of bliss. Previously, he had described mental states as either painful or not painful. Unless one experiences bliss, one remains blissfully unaware of it. But the contentment talked about here is not to be mistaken for the spineless attitude of one who would do nothing. Rather, to accept smilingly whatever comes our way after doing our very best is contentment. Can satisfying the senses give contentment? Can satisfying the appetites give contentment? Is fire content if a large amount of material is burnt or is given to burn and fed to it? It only burns more fiercely. True contentment comes after a long time, after since the efforts of a long duration have been invested, when one has witnessed at first hand the futility of running around after worldly objects, it comes when a person has not only become sober but wise. In short, after about 500-600 lifetimes to come. No? Through fiery aspiration, now read this, all impossible things are coming again. Through fiery aspirations and through removal of all impurity comes the perfecting of the bodily powers and of the senses. Fiery aspiration. If somebody puts you inside a boiler for the rest of your life, that will not be actually called fiery aspiration. You require much more for fiery aspiration. You see, all impossible things are here. You just cannot read and say, I've gone through the sutra. Fiery aspiration means you have not one moment spare to look at me. Every moment of your life you are immersed in your deepest center. That is called fiery aspiration. Who has got all the time in the world? People have not got 10 minutes to do the 3-step rhythmic breathing. Where do we talk of fiery aspiration? Do you hear me? Fiery aspiration. It will come after 5 million years, perhaps or more. Ready? Through fiery aspiration. Fiery aspiration is beyond the scope of practically all of us. You may read again. Fiery aspiration is beyond the scope of practically all of us. I should cancel the word practically. All of us. Those very rare persons who reach the height of performance achieve internal purity, that is, all avidya is washed away. The sutra describes the evolving body-brain system, which, as it comes closer to achievement or achieving pure awareness, acquires the mighty power of chitti itself, quite naturally and unasked for. But now one does not even entertain the idea of using them. Through fiery aspiration and through removal of the impurities come the perfecting of the bodily powers and of the senses. The posture assumed must be steady and easy. This posture of the thinking instrument is effortless and seems to be a gift from the highest God. But it is something which the ardent student has worked for most sincerely and finally achieved. Steadiness and ease of posture is to be achieved through persistent slight effort and through concentration of the thinking instrument upon the infinite. Upon the infinite. Where is the infinite? Where is the infinite? It says what? Through concentration of the thinking instrument chitta upon the infinite. Where is the infinite? We don't know. Where is the infinite? How can we concentrate upon the infinite? Who has seen the infinite? Who has known the infinite? It's all impossible, isn't it? The infinite is at your center. It's closer to you than your own breath, which is in the lungs. That infinite is at your very center. At the very center of your heart, at the very center of your brain, at the very center of your existence is that infinite, which in sutra Patanjali calls Ishvara, the infinite. And that infinite is you. That infinite is you. So there is a need to concentrate on your own self. Then you are the infinite. There is the need to concentrate upon the infinite when you are the infinite. But it so happens that our small brain will not accept that we are the infinite. Our small brain accepts that of this body, 5 foot something is something and infinite is somewhere else. That is why we find it impossible to concentrate on the infinite. Time and again I have said that you are the real self, not the body. This should not be a theory. This should not be a sentence we hear and speak. It should be experienced. The Ishvara that is at your very center must be experienced. Here, that is mentioned when you concentrate upon the infinite. Upon the infinite. One author has written, if I am not present when he was present, he is not a part of me. He is not a part of me. Not I am not a part of him. Being infinite at your very center, you have been there from infinite time. Before time was, you were there. In Gita, Lord Krishna says, O Arjuna, you and I and all those present have been there and shall always be there, though they know not that repeated birth and death. I know my birth and death. See? We refuse to believe that we are also infinite. We refuse to believe that at the center we are something else. That under this clothes there are more clothes. And that those clothes are not me. At my center I am the infinite. About that infinite the sutra speaks here. Steadiness and ease of posture is to be achieved through persistent slight effort, through concentration of the thinking instrument upon the infinite. Relax, breathe rhythmically and go to your innermost center and know that you are the infinite. When for a fraction of a moment the flesh passes through you one day, that day will be your blessed day, the day when grace has descended on you. For that, not much is required. Three steps are required: rhythm and balance, sanskara structure, communication. These three are required. So that one day you can go and touch your innermost center and realize you are the infinite. Who is taking birth? This body? This brain? The infinite within takes up another body. Just as in Gita, Lord Krishna says, just as we change our clothes, our tattered clothes for new ones, we change our old bodies for new. Who? We. We meaning? The infinite in you and the infinite in me. We change our bodies, the old bodies for new. But we are even afraid to think, how can I be the infinite, oh God? That is sin. If in your mind this is the thought, how will you ever look upon the infinite within you? How will you ever look upon your infinite within you? This is what is meant here. Steadiness and ease of mental posture is to be achieved through persistent slight effort, through concentration of the thinking instrument, the chitta, upon the infinite. The posture referred to here is not to be found in any of the 84 major asanas of Hatha Yoga. The clarification suggested in the phrases persistent slight effort and concentrating the chitta upon the infinite speak of only one posture, that is the steady, calm posture of the thinking instrument. In our present day language, it amounts to meditative attitude. You see, this is very important. People wish to sit for meditation. I say that live all 24 hours in meditation. That is, come to a stage of meditative attitude all 24 hours. That is called meditation. Meditation is not eyes closed, legs crossed. Meditation is a state of mind, that utter peaceful state, rhythmic thinking and rhythmic breathing state, and not for a fraction of a moment you are wavering. You are deep, steady. When you achieve that peaceful state of brain and mind, you will one day suddenly experience a flash going through you. I don't know whether you have experienced, but it may be 100th of a second, as if a cold spark of electricity passes through you from head to foot. You see? And that is that moment when you can see the infinite that is within you. You see? This is what the sutra is hinting at. the steady, calm posture of the thinking instrument. In our present-day language, it amounts to meditative attitude. In asana, perfection is achieved when the body is held steady and unmoving in a particular asana for some length of time. Similarly, the steady and unmoving mind is perfection of mind posture. Sage Patanjali deals only with mind and its modifications. When this is achieved, the pairs of opposite no longer limit. I've just told you, if you can play this game of stop 20, 30, 40 times a day, you will find that you are either in the past or in the future. This is what is talked about here. What is it? All life is lived according to the assaults of the pairs of the opposites. It is a bondage from which one is not free till the correct posture of the thinking instrument is finally achieved. It is obvious that a steady and calm chitta has no need of oscillations into the past or the futures, so the pairs of the opposites all cease to prevail. This book is not enough. There may not be a library of such book enough to talk about. The most important thing we have to maintain is a peaceful, calm mind. At no stage are we suddenly off balance. Whatever that happens, that event should not find us off guard, off balance. Life is such that all types of events will take place, the pleasant and the unpleasant. All is called for according to certain laws of God and nature. We cannot cry and now ask for release from such reserves. Take whatever comes with that same peaceful attitude, knowing that it is of our own sowing. As Khalil Gibran says, how is it that I have reaped bajri when I have sown wheat? Then he says, it may be I have forgotten in dim past I may have sown bajri. You see? So, don't get perturbed. The mind must be at peace. And for that, no efforts are needed. No event is strong enough to push you out of your balance. This is required. When your mind has reached that state, then whatever happens, you smile and accept, and you are unruffled, without being philosophical. Your mind is ready to see the infinite that you are. You are ready to see the infinite that you are. That is what here we are made to understand. You see? Infinite is not there. Infinite is not in our temples, churches. Infinite is here, deep down here. It is here. It is so near that you can't even touch it. It is there all the time. With your own touch, it is there. And yet, we fail to realize its mighty power to help us. Through thick and thin, it can take us so peacefully. Unfortunately, we raise our hands here. Here, in the sky where there are stars and sun, they are not able to help you. As Umar Khayyam says, that infinite sky, that inverted ball we call the sky, underneath which we live and die. Raise not your hands in prayer, for it revolves as importantly as you or I. You see? Take your hand here, take your eyes here, not there, there's nobody there. Our ancestors are also not there, they have taken birth again here.